Welcome to Blue Peg, Pink Peg, the bi-weekly podcast where two avid gamers and their equally avid gamer wives discuss board games, relationships, and the interaction between the two. During this episode, the Blue Pegs discuss recent game plays and game news, as well as Kickstarter liability and some details about Peghead Spring Fashion Lines. And all the Pegs review the action selection game by Stefan Feld, Bora Bora, and discuss the metagame. And now, the designers of the point distribution game, Didn't I Cook Supper Last Night? The Pink Pegs, Carrie and Christina. And the classic pressure luck game, Snooze Bar, Patrick and Rob. Welcome to Blue Peg, Blue Peg. I am your host, Patrick.
And I'm your host, Rob.
And we are here at episode 22.
Episode number 22. Pegheads, Catch-22 is a satirical novel by the American author Joseph Heller. He began writing in 1953 and it was published in 1961. It was set during World War II from 1942 to 1944. It is frequently cited as one of the greatest literary works of the 20th century. The phrase Catch-22, a problematic situation for which the only solution is denied by a circumstance inherent to the problem or the rule, has entered the English language. Among other things, Catch-22 is a general critique of bureaucratic operation and reasoning. Resulting from its specific use in the book, the phrase Catch-22 is a common phrase meaning a no-win situation. Curious about other entities that use the name Catch-22? Catch-22 is also the name of a genetic disorder, a ska punk band from New Jersey, and a United Kingdom Young People's Charity.
Now, let me ask you a question. Have you ever read Catch-22?
I have not.
I have a confession to make. I have not read it either.
Really?
I know.
Peghead just stopped. What? The scholar?
Yeah, I have not read it. I keep wanting to get it to get it read, but there's so many other things to get going. But anyways, enough of that. I think what the Pegheads really want to know is what, Rob?
What have you been playing?
Yeah. And, well, I have another confession to make. And, you know, we say sometimes life gets in the way of board games.
It does.
It does happen. And it's important to allow life to get in the way of board games. So we've let life get in the way of board games this week. I haven't had a great deal of play. Have played a few things that I want to talk about. One of them is Spirium. Mm-hmm. We've talked about this before,
yep.
But we haven't really gotten into it in any depth. I think we talked about having played it at Gen Con, but I've played it a little bit more since then and have played it in the interim. And I have to say, the way that Spirium works essentially is you've got an array of 9 cards that are laying out, and you're going to place your workers around those cards. Now, as many people have talked about before, we aren't the first ones to discuss this. The thing that's kind of unique about Spirium is that the workers that are placed around it determine the value of that card or the value that it may produce if it's a value-producing resource or card. And then you can choose to stop placing workers and start triggering, taking up cards essentially, by paying the price and changing over to a different phase. And so the interesting thing about the game is that it has these techs that you can play out to make your powers more substantial, and they're also buildings, but buildings become more expensive as you go forward. The thing that's kind of interesting about Spirium for me that I found as I played it more is that balancing out your track to victory, because you can go, you know, via the Spirium production route, or you can go via the route of producing income. You've got to kind of balance that out a little bit. I've been really bad in my gameplays of sort of focusing upon one track and then paying the price later in the game. But it's one that it has a nice balance to it. And I enjoy it. I like it a lot more as I've played it more than I did initially. I kind of thought it was a little flat initially, but I like it a lot.
I like the game. I'm not crazy about it. I do like the what you're talking about the worker placement and how to choose. I like that. I like how the fact that you can pull your guys off to get money depending on how many people are around the particular thing. I mean, I enjoy that. One of my complaints about the game is the end tiles. They're It's always the same.
Yeah. Yeah. And that is something that can be difficult because of the fact that, that you know, if you're preparing for that effectively, then you can really kind of take advantage of a less experienced player.
Right.
And everybody will go for a lot of the same tiles, I've discovered. The one thing I've discovered that I didn't do a lot of is you've got to pay attention to your income production. If you don't get that working, then you won't be able to get your engine going. But anyways, I have to say, notwithstanding, and I would like to see an expansion for that, notwithstanding that issue with the final tiles, I do recommend Spirium. And it's not a high recommendation, but it's certainly worth getting.
I like to see what the girls think of it, so we might review it in the future.
Yeah.
This episode, we're reviewing Bora Bora,
and
I have played a ton of it.
That is true. We have played a bunch of Bora Bora. It sort of got under our skin. Would that be fair to say?
No, I don't know. I don't know if I put under our skin.
Under my skin, like meaning I kept wanting to play it. Like when it came opportunities to play a game,
right,
I was like,
but when I really want
to do Bora Bora.
But when someone says you get under my skin, that means I can't stand your face. So yeah, no, it didn't get under my skin. I did play a lot of it, but then I went a little failed crazy.
you do that.
So we started playing it. We played it a lot, and then I started playing Bruges because I wanted to compare the two. Now, I'm not going to talk a lot about it now because we're reviewing it later, but I think I might start a conversation in the guild or something like that in reference to Bruges and Bora Bora and what I think about the two compared. You know, I do like them both as two-player games.
And I'll say this, a little preview. You and I have discussed this comparison a little bit, and I don't want to get into it now, but you should check out the guild because there may be a little back and forth between me and Rob on the comparisons between Bruges and Bora Bora. Suffice it to say, I think we have a differing view on that. But there are some interesting comparisons between those games.
I also wanted to buy another failed game. Right. So I was doing some research, looking around. I had some Amazon points that I wanted to burn. So I was going back between Macau and Rialto.
Yeah, and I was pushing for Rialto, I have to confess.
Well, it seemed a lighter game.
It is.
I'm not in the mood for a lighter game. I wanted something a little heavier. And you own Trajan, so I didn't want to get that one. Which, by the way, I do want to play more.
Yeah.
But I ended up buying Macau. Got excited about it. Was waiting on it. And then the day came, you know, bing, bong. Oh, I got it. So I went. And as soon as I got to the front door, opened the door, this perfume wafted into my house.
Uh-huh.
I mean, it was strong. I mean, so much tears were coming to my eyes. I'm like, whoa, what is that? Nature. I thought it was nature. So I picked up the box. And I guess the postwoman, the mail lady, when she came in, right? I must have been the first stop, and she must have had other stops. And so she's like, I'm probably a little sway, so I'm going to dump this perfume all over me. So it permeated into the box. The whole house started smelling like it. So I tore out the packaging. I threw it outside. But now the box still smells like this perfume. It has already affected my game experience, and I haven't even taken it out of the shrink wrap yet. And this has been a week or so ago,
and it's still there.
Still smells.
Yeah, well, you know, you guys you've heard of the movie The Postman Always Rings Twice, right?
I guess.
Yeah, so maybe you're... Hi, Mr. Rouse. How you doing?
You got another package from Amazon.
So that is... Well, the good news is that once you take that shrink wrap off, maybe you'll lose a little bit of that.
I know, but I'm never going to lose that memory of
this
box.
Well, you know what? If you can't work through the pain, you've always got a friend in me. I'll be happy to take it from you.
Doing a lot of traveling lately.
I have, yeah. We did a little. We had our spring break here and did a little traveling with the fam. So I decided to take it upon myself to put together a little travel pack of some board games that would be appropriate for playing, you know, in a hotel room. Some two-player games or some light games.
What'd you put in there?
Well, I put in Rivals of Catan, Serpent Stones, Builders of. What is that? Heavens! I'm spacing on the name. It's the one based upon Pillars of the Earth, and the two player variant of that, and then I think I put in a couple of like little card games, some light games that the kids would like, Continental Express, and finally, you know, I can't remember what else, but I put a bunch of games into I separated them out and I bagged them up in special ways, and I got a little travel caddy, you know, and I put him inside the travel caddy. And
the word travel caddy makes me laugh. Don't know why.
And traveled with that. We didn't play all the games that I brought, but I like the idea of having an option of games to play. We did play a lot. We played several. I will tell you something kind of interesting. I put in some gesture cards into the bag. Okay,
now some gesture cards?
Gesture.
What is
this?
This
is a light party game from the 80s, maybe the 90s.
Okay,
basically a variant on charades. But here's the point. The family loved playing gestures. We definitely played more gestures than we played of anything else. And now the reason for that is because it was a interactive game that was active, you know,
mm-hmm.
And we could, you know, kind of sit in the hotel room in the evening before we went to bed and play it. But the lesson I took from that, we had a wonderful time playing that. The lesson I took from that is there were a couple of other little games that I kind of wanted us to play. You know, maybe we could get going between the four of us in the evenings. But they really wanted to play this. And I have to remind myself sometimes as a board gamer that sometimes the games that don't appeal to me because either not either complex enough or they don't have enough going on.
Are they from the 80s?
Yeah, are they from the 80s? Are incredible games and games that you can really enjoy with your family. And the point being, do not let your, we'll say it, snobbery about board games get in the way of you having a fun gaming experience with your friends and family.
Well, Patrick, I'd just like to say thank you for coming out and admitting that you're a game snob.
I can be. I think there's no mistaking that. But the point being is that, you know, you got to step back a lot and sort of keep those sort of games that you played, you know, when you were earlier into the hobby. Keep those games handy because they do appeal to a broader audience, and you're going to have a really fun time playing those. Like, there's a party game called Salad Bowl that we play. I know. That we play with a group of friends, and it's super simple. It's basically charades again. But the fact remains that everybody has a blast playing that game. They have.
It sounds like in the 80s, everything was just a variant of charades.
Yeah. Well, there's truth to that, I think. But anyways, the point being, you know, keep yourself open to that. And certainly when you're dealing with your kids, you know, be willing to play some stuff that you might otherwise not play.
Any new games out there that has gotten your eye?
Yeah, there are a few things that I have been intrigued by. One of them is a game called Pagoda.
Oh, I like this one.
Yeah, it sounds pretty cool. I watched a play video of it and have read a little bit about it. And the way that this game works, it's a re-implementation of a prior game, I understand. But the way the game works is you have a set of cards. Five of them, I believe, are known to your opponent, and two of them are secret. And you'll play a card of a particularized color on a player board, a common player board, and then you can place a column of that color onto a space. You got to put four columns in order to put a level on top of the pagoda. You're building a pagoda.
Little pegs.
Right, they're pegs. Yeah. And once one gets of a certain color gets laid, then everything else there has to be that same color. And you can lay 1 to 3 columns on the board at a time. And so the interesting thing, and the thing is that then you place pagoda tiles on top of that, but they will tell you what colors of columns can be played on top of that tile because they'll have a color on them.
Now, are the tiles that you play, are they random or?
Well, they'll have to be the color of what you're playing.
Whatever the pegs
are. You'll pull off of a stock of tiles, and then you'll play up on top of that.
Now,
the higher that you are on the pagoda, the more points you score for placing columns, because obviously it's going to get harder and harder as gameplay goes on. You'll also get certain benefits. There's a little individual player mat where you can have these abilities, and then you can trigger those and exhaust them in order to do certain things, get more cards, discard cards, pick up cards from the table.
Yeah.
So anyways, that sounds like a really kind of cool two-player game. It has the feel of a Lost Cities a little bit, and so I think it feels a little like Pinata. So it's definitely a game that I think we should look at. It's on pre-order at Cool Stuff for like $19, so the price is right. Another game that I saw is from our friends at Yellow, and this game really, I don't know a great deal about it, but it has so tickled my fancy. It is called Night of the Grand Octopus. It is out in they're actually bringing it over from France. I'm not going to try to pronounce the French name. But the way that it works is the theme is what's important. You are cute little cultists.
Aww.
Seeking to invoke an old one who's adorable.
Oh, there's nothing wrong with that.
It is a child type. I don't think it's a child game, but it certainly the art is childish, a la King of Tokyo, themed Cthulhu game. And, you know, it's never too early to introduce your kids to the mythos. They want to know the old one when he comes. but it looks like a really cool game. The basic mechanic is that you're secretly placing your cultist on a space, on an individual board. Everybody simultaneously reveals where they are. And if you're the only one on that space, then you will gain an advantage. But if you're there with someone else, you're going to have to negotiate how the advantage will work. And whether you're going to get it or not. And then there's also, you can be on a monster space, and if they're there, then you lose the cultist. So that is, you know, Night of the Grand Octopus. It's going to be a Gen Con release, I understand, and one that we want to keep an eye on. As I learn more about it, I will let you know a little bit more.
Now, Peghead brought to our attention a Kickstarter issue. We want to go a little more into that.
Yeah, there's a game out there called Democracy Majority Rules. And what happened with this is that it had an estimated delivery date of January of 2013.
Was it 13 or 12?
I think 13? It's 2013. Okay. Yeah, and apparently no rewards have shipped as of yet. And there hasn't been a lot of communication. Well, let's say this. There hasn't been any communication from the designer of the game in quite some time. He has not been giving updates and has not been responding to requests.
I think if I remember right, I think for this one, the last time he said something was in November?
Yeah, it's been a while. No, there's been, I think there were some communications since then.
Okay.
The last update, I think, was in February. And there hasn't been any updates since then. Now, to his credit, he did face a health issue, and he was resolving that. But it's been quite a while since he has gotten back to people. Now, he is demoing the game in Europe. He is showing versions, and there were a very small number of the games that were available for distribution at Essen last year to some backers. I think there were about 40. But there hasn't been any more information coming from him since then. Now, we have reached out to him, and we have received no comment. We've reached out to him multiple times because we were looking at this and wanted to know where things are. Now, what I do know is that the game apparently does exist, and it is prepared for shipment. Game Salute stepped in at some point and sort of took over distribution. But their hands are a little bit tied, based upon what I understand, because they don't have information from him that they require in order to ship these things. They also may or may not have the funds that they need to receive in order to pay for these games to be distributed. But the point being, they do exist, and they're likely to be coming out, you know, soon. I think those of you that have backed it can look to receive something here in a bit.
I think some of the issue about this particular designer or in Kickstarter was that since then he's come out with another one.
He has come out with another one.
Kickstarter.
Yeah, another Kickstarter, and I'm not going to comment on that. I don't want to you know spoil the soup in regards to that ongoing Kickstarter. You can do some research. The designer name is Mark Reinhagen. He's from Tbilisi, Georgia, and so you know you can inform yourself accordingly. But The point here is that there hasn't been any communication. And as I said, we have reached out to him multiple times for comment, letting him know that we were going to be reporting on this and kind of giving him a sense of what our findings were. And he has not returned any of our inquiries.
No, that doesn't really mean anything.
No, it doesn't. It doesn't. Well, I mean, I've instructed him and asked him to respond. You know, don't read too much into that, but I will say that it is a fact that he has not responded. I checked, you know, my emails immediately before we went to air our recording on this, and I have not received anything as of yet. If we have an update, we'll let you know that. But this brings me to the broader question. It got me really looking at, well, what's going on with Kickstarter? You know, people have been bashing it, but what are the facts, you know?
Well, being that you have a law background, I'm really interested in what your thoughts are on this.
Right. Well, I did do a little research, you know, and I want to start this by saying I haven't done, you know, a comprehensive legal inquiry on this. I haven't looked at the theories and some of the defenses that would be available. But I have looked at it a little bit, and I have a few thoughts as far as what the legal theories might be and what the liabilities might be from a legal point of view in connection with Kickstarter. And I'll start that by saying there are some other failures, significant failures that have happened. We've obviously heard about Odin's Ravens, but there's also, but that's sort of the bad actor where the guy takes the money and just runs.
That happened too with the Monopoly version. That
obviously, yeah.
But Cryptozoic got that
right. We've all heard about that. But there are a few others that are a little more involved. Upfront, the card game is a combat battle game. That game has been locked up for some time because of a dispute, presumptively over the IP and other things. This is, as I understand it, it's a collateral matter. But the assets that came from the Kickstarter have been locked up by the court. There's an ongoing litigation, and the court basically issued an injunction, effectively, that precluded the parties from distributing the assets. So that game has been waiting for the resolution of that litigation, which is set for trial in 2015.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So there, you know, you've got the issue of, you know, even an established company, if they're involved in some sort of different dispute, and this is with another a player, you know, unrelated to this, the assets may be frozen. So you may be in a position where you're not going to be able to get access to your game because they can't get the funds in order to finish the distribution. Now, another game is Asylum. It's not a card game. It was like a card set, you know, a set of cards that were themed in a particularized way. Now, I'm sorry, excuse me. Now, I bring that up because that isn't necessarily directly related to board gamers, but I bring that up because it's an important development in the context of Kickstarter generally, because the Attorney General for the state of Washington has filed suit against the designer or the creator of this Kickstarter campaign in order to get the monies back from the various that various Washington citizens have paid in order to get this project that hasn't funded after several years, or rather hasn't distributed after several years. It's already funded, and the money's been taken. Now, the interesting thing about that is that the first of all, the Attorney General's involvement. That is a very important development because individuals typically are not going to be in a good position in order to file suit in order to seek their funds back. Typically, the amount of funds that are at risk are not very substantial. And certainly in some cases there are, and there have been some instances where people have filed suit in connection with Kickstarter campaigns, typically not in the board gaming context. But again, in the board gaming context, typically the amount at risk is not high enough to justify filing suit, funding that suit. The other thing that's kind of interesting about that is I looked at the Kickstarter terms of agreement. Now, in the Kickstarter terms of agreement, it says that you are obligated to provide rewards that are promised.
What does that mean?
Right. That's the interesting part of this, because Kickstarter has been very public about saying we are not a store. We are a funding source. And as a funding source, people are seeking to get things, projects, ideas developed. And they are essentially investing in those ideas. And there are risks associated with that. If the project doesn't fund, you may be you may have lost something in order to in connection with your outlay of funds. Now, the problem for Kickstarter that they've got to work a fine line there is if you're talking about crowdfunding as an investment, okay, and if you think of it that way, then there's regulation that may be coming down the pipe. There's some SEC regulations regarding crowdsourcing and crowdfunding that they may find themselves having to comply with. Now, you know, if you're dealing with SEC or state blue sky laws are the state laws that relate to funding and investment, then you've got a lot of disclosures. It becomes much more complicated in order to get funds if you're thinking about Kickstarter as an investment source. Whenever you start looking into investments, you've got prospectuses, you have disclosures, you have conflicts, you've got to do certain things, legal obligations that you're going to have to comply with that can be very tedious and could effectively clog down the entire Kickstarter process. So thinking about Kickstarter as an investment medium could be very problematic. So we have to think about it as a contract for the sale of goods. The problem is that the contract is between the creator of the Kickstarter campaign and Kickstarter. Nowhere in that agreement are the backers identified expressly as third-party beneficiaries. Therefore, they wouldn't have the basis to file suit under that contract because they are not a party to the agreement between the creator and Kickstarter. Now, there are other theories that could be perceived that could be you could pursue against, and probably the Attorney General of Washington has hit upon the best one, and that is consumer protection law. The reason that consumer protection law is probably a good way to proceed is because they are unique to each state. Typically, states are very – there's a choice of forum.
But what is it? What is it?
Yeah. What it is if you tell me you're going to do something and you sell me something as a consumer in the market or promise to sell me something and you don't keep your promise, then you have violated these consumer protection law. The deceptive trade practices. If you tell me something's going to do one thing and it doesn't do that or it doesn't meet my expectations at all, then I can file suit. The advantage of that is that, first of all, there are statutory damages, meaning you can get more than just your cost. Additionally, most consumer protection laws in state law allow for the party who prevails to collect their attorney's fees. Okay, and that's a big bar to a contract action or a pseudo-contract action, quantum merit or whatnot, because you can't get your fees back. So you're going to go out and spend $6,000 to go get $200. You know, obviously nobody's going to do that. Now, if you have the ability to collect your attorney's fees, which is rare in most forms of litigation, then you're going to have more of an incentive to go after the people that are involved in this. The point I want to kind of bring up is that there are ways of proceeding. And I'll say this, Mark, the backer of this democracy has conceded that he has an obligation to provide these. He says he's got a contract. He said that to his backers. So he's going to have to give this stuff to you or give your money back. It's just, you know, what are the ways you're going to have to go after that? There are class action options available. But then again, you've got a foreign party here, Tbilisi, Georgia. I don't know the choice of law issues for the international suit there. So you've got some concerns there. The point being, you know, there are options to people, and I think we need to start paying attention to what's going on with Kickstarter when they don't work out. Now, an interesting thing is Kickstarter says it's an estimated delivery date. So as an effective matter, you know, there you could say, yeah, okay, my campaign's 4 years delayed, but you know, I never gave a promise of when I would produce this. Until I have failed to satisfy my contractual obligations, you know, then you've got no theory, you've got no way of proceeding. So anyways, those are some thoughts. I know I kind of got a little in-depth there, but it's something that's of great interest to me, and I think something we need to start paying attention to as members of the community, especially if we're going to be people that are supporting the Kickstarter model.
So bottom line, if you've invested hundreds of dollars in Kingdom Death Monster, I'm sure you have nothing to worry about.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, and I think, you know what? I think I hate to say that, but that if that doesn't happen, if Kingdom Death Monster delays too much longer, I think it could be a bit of a game changer for the
model. I don't think it will. He's pretty good about the updates.
I know he is. But I get that.
Okay. So anyway, we also have some huge news, I think, for us. We've got some t-shirts.
We do. And by that, we mean we went to Kmart. Mm-hmm. I was out of t-shirt.
I'm not topless anymore.
So no. We have not just t-shirts. No.
We have blue peg, pink peg t-shirts.
We do indeed. We've had one with our logo on it that we've worn around a little bit, but that was just a little more for our use.
Right. Well, we got something that we both agreed on, ended some friendships.
It did.
Well, it was funny because I had this idea for the t-shirt, and I have a buddy who's really good with Photoshop and whatnot, and I was like, hey, man, can you put this together? And I didn't hear from him, all right? So then I have another buddy who also is like, hey, I got this idea for
also
a t-shirt.
Also good with Photoshop.
Also, he's okay. So I gave him this idea, and he put it together pretty quickly. And I'm like, hey, man, let me pay you. And we gave him a little bit of a dough. But anyway, so he put together this it was really cool, like nice idea of what we wanted. It wasn't 100% exactly what I wanted, but no. It was awful close.
Yes, it was.
So then I had mentioned, because the first guy I talked to was good at Photoshop, also has a printing press for shirts. So I was like, hey, man, I was asking him some questions about printing out the shirts. Uh-huh. And he's like, oh, yeah, that's right. You had asked me about this several months ago. Like a half hour later, boom, boom! Yeah. He came out with exactly what I wanted.
Yeah, it was
using
awesome.
A little bit of the first guy's idea.
Yep.
So together, they put together exactly what we wanted. And what's this mean for you? Well, right now, nothing. We don't have. We're in the process of figuring out how we want to offer these shirts to everybody and what the price is and everything else. But if you check out our show notes and probably Facebook, we're gonna have some pictures of the T-shirt. But I really like the T-shirt.
Oh yeah, no, it's a great T-shirt. You guys, I'm not gonna spoil it for you. You got to go over to the show page and look at it because
I'll probably put it on Facebook.
Yeah, on Facebook. But you're gonna see it in various places. But I think it'll be a great treat for you to see. And kind of the idea, we aren't. I have problems with grandiose thinking, and so I kind of have this idea of using the model that we have of this shirt, the idea of this shirt, each year, issuing a different shirt that sort of plays off the theme, and you'll see it when you get it, when you look at the shirt, you'll know exactly what I'm talking about, but that's our teaser to get you guys to go and look at the shirts, because they are super cool.
Right. More information on that to follow and coming podcast.
Yeah, but if you want to be show your member membership in the Peghead Nation, or you just want to back us and try, you know, back us.
Did you say back us? Are we at Kickstarter?
No. If you want to give us a little support, you know, trust me, we're not going to be making anything. If we sold tons of these, which we don't expect.
No. I plan on putting all the money in a big vault like Scrooge McDuck
and swimming in it daily. Yeah, all $14. But we aren't going to make any money, real money, off this. We certainly aren't going to offset our costs. But you know, if you want to show your membership to Peghead Nation, you're going to have an opportunity here very soon.
All right. Well, that's enough from us. That's quite a bit from us, actually. So let's get to the game that we're reviewing this week, Bora Bora. Patrick, give us the rule breakdown.
It's my turn to see what I can see. I hope you'll understand. This time's just for me because it's
Bora Bora is a 2-4 player action selection game designed by Stefan Feld and published by Alea, a Ravensburger imprint, in 2013. In Bora Bora, players take on the role of tribal leaders seeking to expand their influence across the island chain by using the skill and expertise of all of their tribe members. Now, Bora Bora consists of a complex rule set that can take a little time to explain, but once it's understood, gameplay proceeds fairly intuitively. Most players have a good grasp of the game after a few rounds of play. Now, gameplay consists of three distinct phases. The first is action selection, the second is worker engagement, and the third is reward selection. Each of these take place over 6 rounds. Now, in order to understand gameplay, we must first discuss the board configuration. The common board consists of a scoring track, 12 island spaces, each producing 1 of 3 resources, and affiliated with a fish tile of values ranging from 1 to 6, a prestige track, a temple track, 24 jewelry tiles set up in 6 columns and 4 rows, 6 available gold tiles, 6 man tiles, and 6 woman
Patrick,
tiles.
Patrick.
Well, hey, hon.
Hey, do you mind if I jump in for a minute?
Well, what's going on?
Well, those rules sound really complicated, and I'm already really getting a little bit tense listening to them.
Well, okay.
I think I might be able to explain it a little more concisely, if you don't mind.
Well, all right. Yeah, give it a shot.
Okay. So Bora Bora is really fun. It consists, all you really need to know is that you have to get on islands and you roll your dice to get there. You can collect shells, you can collect fish, you can collect men and women. And if you read the tiles, you'll basically really know what to do. So don't get bogged down with these rules because you might not want to play them. It's really fun.
You're right. Well, listen, I tell you what. That is a really good summary of the basic gist of Bora Bora. Thank you for giving that to us. What I am going to do is I'm going to describe the rules in detail for people that want to listen to them. But if you want to jump to the review and just kind of not hear the rest of the rule summary, you can skip ahead to the 45-minute mark of the podcast, where I'll be joined by Carrie and the rest of the Pegs to discuss our thoughts about the game. How's that sound?
I think that sounds great.
All right. Well, listen, guys, if you want to skip ahead, you can leave now with Carrie.
See you later.
But if you want to stick around, I'm going to get into the details of the rules. All right. For those of you that stuck around, as I said, the common game board is going to have a lot of elements that you're going to be using in order to go through the game. But you're also going to have an individual player board, and that's going to consist of instructional icons on the left hand that remind players of the various actions and powers, as Carrie mentioned, a 3x4 gridded space that has the icons of the three resources on it, 6 rectangular building tiles numbered 1 to 6, 12 spaces for the placement of man and or woman tiles, and a space for 3 uncompleted goals, as well as a space for stacking completed goals. On each of the 12 spaces for man and women tiles are wooden huts, 1 in each space, with 2 in the final space. Now, the board also consists of action tiles, including a land expansion tile, a sea expansion tile, a woman recruiting tile, a man recruiting tile, a building tile, a temple tile, and a helper tile. Now, in the 2- and 3-player game, you're going to have fewer action tiles with some of the tiles combined together, but generally speaking, those are going to be the actions that are available to all players during gameplay. Now, during the game, all players roll 3 dice in their respective colors simultaneously. These dice will be used to select the actions that the players will take, one at a time, during their turns during the first phase, or the action selection phase of each round. Starting with the first player, each player places a die on an action tile of their choosing, and depending upon the value of the die placed, may take certain actions. The higher the die value, the more action options they will have. Now, at the start of the game, each player places an initial hut on one of the island spaces on the common board next to the fish tile with a value of 1. There are 4 of such fish tile on the board. Now, only 1 hut may be placed on each space during this initial stage. The players receive a resource, stone, wood, or sand, or an offering tile, and place them on an appropriate space on the 3x4 gridded space on their individual player board. Now, if the player chooses to take a land or sea expansion action, they may build on an island space that is adjacent to the space they started out on, either via land or an ocean pass. Now, there's a value that's associated with all adjacent spaces, so expanding to these spaces will require the players to employ a die of a value greater than or equal to that associated value. For example, if the arrow between 2 adjacent land spaces shows a value of 5, in order to expand into that space, a player must trigger the land expansion action by placing one of their die with a value of 5 or 6. Likewise, if a player wants to expand to a space that's adjacent via a sea pass with a value of 4, they must place a die valued 4, 5, or 6 on the ocean expansion action space in order to make the move. The players then takes one of the huts from their individual player board and places it on the new space. The player then collects the resource that that space produces and places it in the grid space on their player board. Now, as I mentioned earlier, there are 6 man tiles and 6 women tiles on the common player board. Each of these tiles has an associated shell or prestige value, as well as an associated bonus action affiliated with it. For example, a woman tile may allow a player to earn 4 shells and or take a bonus expansion action as if they rolled a 2 value dice. A man tile may allow a player to gain 3 prestige points and or gain a bonus offering. Now, if the player takes the man or woman tile or man or woman recruit action, they may, provided they have available space on their individual player board, claim a tile and place it on their board for future use. Now, the man and women tiles are laid out in 2 6-column rows, 1 for men, 1 for women, with the leftmost tile being valued at 1 and the rightmost tile being valued at 6 and everything in between being valued at values between 1 and 6. Therefore, if a player placed a die with a value of 6 on the recruit man action tile, they could then select any man tile on the board that's available, while if they placed a die valued at 1, they could only claim the leftmost man tile, and so forth and so on with all values. If a player places a die on the building action tile that is, they may take one of their 6 building tiles and place it on the 3x4 grid layout on their player board. However, these tiles are valued from 1 to 6, and they may only be played by using a die of a value higher than the action tile that's played. So you have to trigger that action via a valued tile. And if you play a 1, you can only place a 1 tile. If you play a 6, you can place any of your tiles. Furthermore, building tiles, which cover 2 grid spaces, and may only be placed in those spaces on the 3 or 4 grid that have been seeded through the placement of orthogonally adjacent resource cubes. So you have to have a couple of resource cubes right next to each other in order to be able to put any tile, one of these building tiles, down on the board. Now, if a player places a die on the temple action tile, they may place a worshiper token on the temple track. As other actions, the 6 temple track spaces are valued from 1 to 6. A player may only place a temple worker on the space that corresponds with the die value laid on the temple action space, or a lower space in some circumstances. All previously placed worshiper tokens slide to the right or lower on the temple track, with each bumped worshiper token on the temple track, or the last bumped worshiper token on the temple track, being removed and returned to the player that had originally placed it. Now, if a player takes the helper action, they may use action points equal to the value of the die placed to trigger man or women tiles, and each such tile may only be triggered once during the game. Now, when triggered, these tiles either produce shells for the player if the in the value shown on that tile, if it's a woman tile, or allow a player to move up on the prestige track in a value equal to the number of tattoos shown on that tile, if it's a man tile. The player can also use these points to acquire resources, obtain an offering, obtain god cards, gain victory points, or move a hut to a reserve space, clearing up space for the placement of new man or women tiles. Now, while actions will be more powerful if a higher die is used to trigger its effect, placing a lower value die has an advantage, as only die of an equal value than the lowest die previously played on a particular action tile may be played upon that tile, at least during that turn. So low value die can be placed to block other players from taking a particular action during a turn. Now, as mentioned above, there's also these things called god cards, and god cards allow players to break certain rules. However, in order to invoke a god card, an offering must be played. Players can also acquire and spend a wild god tile without paying an offering. The powers of the god tiles are varied and include allowing a player to treat a placed die as if it were a value of 6, or placing a die of any value on an auction tile, or any other number of other effects. Now, after all the players have placed their dice, players can employ the power of 1 man and 1 woman tile, even if they've previously been triggered for the shell or prestige benefit. Now, these abilities allow the player to take additional actions, and the ability can be compounded by playing a doubling god card or by employing man or woman tiles of a particular type of which the player has more than one. So if you have 2 of the exact same tile, you can actually take that action twice. Now, after all man and women effects are triggered, the reward selection phase begins. First, players are awarded points depending upon how far up the prestige track they have advanced. At this time, the player that is furthest up the prestige track becomes the first player, with subsequent order being set by the second, third, and fourth furthest placement on the track. Points are then given for the number of worshippers each player has in the temple, and a wild god card is given as a reward to the player that has the most power within the temple. Players may then spend their shells to purchase jewelry. 1 piece may be purchased by each player from the 4 available jewelry tiles. Finally, players attempt to complete a goal, and these can vary wildly. These require the players to have obtained certain board or gain objectives, such as the possession of a certain set of man or woman tiles, the placement of a hut within specific regions, the acquisition of certain god cards, and so on. A certain god card can be played at this time to supplement any shortfalls that a player may have toward meeting a certain goal. However, players that complete a goal with the help of the god cards or without the help of the god card, score 6 points, while players that require the god's help will score only 4 points. Now, once a goal is completed or disposed of, because if you can't complete a goal, you have to dispose of one of them, a new goal is selected from the 6 available goals, and the person who selects first obviously has a better selection among the 6 goals. Players then reclaim their dice from the action tiles, the prestige track is reset, and the board is reset with new jewelry, man and woman tiles, and gold tiles. Players then re-roll their die, and play recommences as before. Now, after six rounds, players have a chance to complete the remainder of their goals, and final scoring commences. The point values of obtained jewelry tiles are totaled. The point values of each village-affiliated fish tile are added to the score of the last player to place a hut in that village space, and bonuses are awarded for achieving certain perfect objectives, i.e. meeting all goals, or obtaining jewelry during each round, or placing huts on all spaces, or placing all of your building tiles, etc. At this point, the player with the highest score is declared king of the island chain and winner of the game. Now, the game features a few other rules, including fire bonuses for taking certain actions such as placing a building tile and putting a worshiper in the temple, but I've described the majority of the rules and pretty careful to tell. I know it sounds like a lot to juggle, and it can be, but that's a large part of this game's appeal. So why don't we head back to the rest of the pegs and hear what they think of Bora Bora.
Thank you for the rules breakdown, yeah. Patrick. I'm Pink Peg Carey, and let's meet Pink Peg Christina.
Hey.
Hey. And of course, it's me and Rob.
Yeah, no, we're always here.
We're here.
They're always here.
Always here.
You've already met them.
Yeah.
So this episode, we're reviewing Bora Bora.
Yes, we are.
How did everybody enjoy Bora Bora?
Ladies, why don't you start?
Well, all right, I'll start. Yeah. I really like Bora Bora.
Yeah.
And I'm actually surprised because it's a really heady game for me. Yeah.
Wait, what's heady mean?
Heady, like, it takes a lot of concentration. There's not much social interaction,
Yes.
where I can catch up with Christina or talk. But there's so much strategy, and the rules are so complex. I don't think I've listened to rules like that in
a while.
Forever.
Yeah. It does have some involved rules. But the thing about the game is that once you get your arms around those rules, it just flows. You know, I mean, you play a couple of rounds of it. You start get going. You start having success at understanding at how the action selections work, how the various, you know, rules and how the various points are made. I mean, I think it kind of plays pretty intuitively once you get going. You just have to kind of get past that initial threshold.
Well, I think you have to play this game twice, and you have to play it almost in succession. Like, we played it last night with two other people, and then we played it tonight with y'all.
Yeah.
And so finally, by like midway, I was like, all right, I can figure out what I'm doing.
Yeah.
And I know the different strategies.
Let's break it down a little bit. Let's start off where we are. We start off the components.
Yes.
There is a lot in this game. When I started punching this stuff out, you've got six or seven boards to punch out. You've got chits, you've got dice, you've got meeples, you've got player boards, you've got a main board. A ton of stuff is in this box.
Yeah, something a lot of people don't know. Stefan Feld is the heir of a paper empire. and hence...
I was wondering what
the cardboard. He loves to use a lot of cardboard. But there is a lot of bits to this game.
But they're sturdy bits.
Oh, yeah. No. They're not
going anywhere.
Yeah, no, it's very solid.
Art...
Yeah, it's passable. I will say the individual player boards are busy. It looks like somebody ate about 17 games and then threw up on a piece of cardboard and made this board.
As it a new
is pretty
player
crazy.
Coming up to this game, when someone hands you your individual player board, I mean, your mind explodes.
Yeah, it's
half
a lot.
The board is just explaining what things are.
Yeah. It's like a summary of the rules, a player aid on the player board. I mean, there's just stuff all over it.
Which is a really good cheat sheet, but it's small.
Yes.
Like, I mean, it's really tiny pictures.
Yeah. And the graphics are pretty, like, it's a lot of colors. They're kind of brash colors. It's like just color here, color there. It's a lot going on the board. Not the most attractive player board I've ever seen.
No, but once it's explained to you, it's pretty simple that you don't have to go, oh, I don't really need to know what this column is because that's just a key for it.
Right.
And so you can know, of it's just like reminder stuff.
Right, and even on the player boards, they have the reminders of the final scoring.
Right.
So you can constantly remind yourself, oh yeah, I need to get this objective in order to get those final game points. I need to do this to get those final game points. So you can constantly be remind you of the fact that, you know, during those first few plays, of these are the things that you want to do in order to score points at the end of the game.
Well, I wonder too what his you know, Stefan Feld's thought process was of like putting it all on one board versus having those little extra index cards that were like reminder cards, because you do look at the board and it looks like a 5-year-old's graffiti and you're like, I don't know what I'm looking at.
Yeah, it is a little daunting, but I think his thinking probably is that there's a lot to deal with in this game. It is your classic point smorgasbord that you see from Stefan Feld. And so I think he wanted to come up with a way of concisely, without having to look at a bunch of boards, you can look at one board in front of you to know, here's everything that goes into making this game work. And he does a pretty good job of that. It's just, it isn't that attractive.
And another thing, with all the components and stuff, the setup for it is a little longer than your normal game, I feel.
Yeah, it takes a while. And I might add, between rounds, the setup can be a little lengthy. Pulling off all of the jewelry, resetting the females, the males. Yeah, resetting the goals. There's a lot to have to put onto the board between rounds, which are only placement of 3 die per person. So you're resetting quite often during this game. So it can be a little bit daunting in that way. It's nice to kind of maybe stack up 6 of everything in order to kind of have it ready for you. But even to that, it takes a while.
Well, I was just thinking with the setup, and when we played it tonight and even last night, it was kind of cool. Like, everyone had a little job.
Yeah.
So there's not a lot of boredom while you're waiting for somebody else to set up, because there's so much to do. Everyone pitches in.
Yeah,
that's
true.
It's a team-building game.
It is a team-building game.
Let's move over to the play. How's the play? I enjoy the play a lot.
Yeah, I do too. I think that this game really, I just love the various things you have to balance. Throughout the game, you're constantly thinking to yourself, okay, this is my basic strategy. I'm going to approach it from this point of view, but my goals change the way that I want to approach the various strategies. And you, when you see other people going for certain things you're going for, you want to think along the lines of, okay, how am I going to use my God card so that I can take advantage of those? Or how am I going to reserve my God cards so I can take advantage of them? You're going to have to give up actions. There's a lot you're going to have to let fall by the wayside when you're playing this game. And you've got to make decisions about what you're going to focus on and what you're going to let go of.
My favorite mechanic in this game is the action selection, where you roll the dice and you have to decide how you want to spin your dice. As you mentioned in the rules, the higher the dice, the bigger the power, the lower the dice, you can block out other people.
Right.
So that mechanic in itself is a lot of fun to figure out how to make it all work.
Yeah. I mean, what do you guys think about the way the action selection works in this game, Christina?
Well, I think, for a newer player, like, the ability to have so many different actions is overwhelming. Like, it's a lot to think about. And, even though you have your goals or your route of where you want to go, sometimes you have to abandon ship and just kind of figure out how am I going to score the most points. And that might not be what you started out going for. So that's nice that if you feel like you're, having to abandon ship, you have options of still regaining the lead.
Right.
Because there's so many things you can do.
Yeah. I would say one thing about this is, like, something that's a mark of a Stefan Feld game are those hard decisions about opportunity cost. If I go in one direction, I'm going to forego options in so many others. For example, in Bruges, if you use a particular card in order to get guilders, then you're giving up the power of that card that they could have if they were a person. And in Amerigo, if you choose to choose one particular set of action cubes, you're going to be giving up something else. You may have to make yourself vulnerable to the pirates in order to develop or block somebody off on an island. There's always those sorts of choices that you have to make.
One big difference in Bora Bora, though, is in those games, you are giving up other choices for yourself. In this game, there's a lot of player interaction.
That's
where
true.
You are not only giving up your future actions or other decisions that could affect you, you're also affecting other players immensely. If I play this, I might not be able to do this, or I get less points, but I then also stop Carrie from getting 15 points this round.
Yeah,
and I think that changes based on how many people you're playing with, too. Like, I've played it with 2, I've played it with 4, and when you play with 4, you really got to be paying attention to how this is going to affect someone else. Whereas 2, it's kind of like, I can abandon this route because I know Rob's not going to go for it.
That's true.
And the one other difference between the 2 and the 4, when you play 2, the who goes first, not that big of a deal. It's still big, but it's not that big of a deal. But when you play 3 or 4 players, who goes first is kind of crucial.
Yeah, it's very important.
I kept going last, and so luckily I didn't do that poorly and came in second. But I had my fingers crossed so many times during this game because I wanted to get the priest so badly because I knew I could like rack up points. And half the time you guys would block me out, and I was like, you know, how do I do that?
Yeah, right? Yeah. And the other thing I think is kind of neat about the player order, I'm sorry to interrupt you there, but is the fact that it changes in the middle of a turn. I like the fact that,
yeah, that's cool.
You know, it's going to go here, here, and here, but in the middle of the turn, you're going to swap over when it comes before. And the key thing there is before the purchasing of the jewelry comes, you know. And if you're going the jewelry route, which is one I like to favor, then you want to be able to know, A, I'm going to be able to go first and get the jewelry I want, or B, I'm going to have enough conch available so that I can purchase that second piece of jewelry that's still going to be of high value. So you've got to prepare for that. And I think player order is very key in the four-player version of this game. Yeah.
Yeah.
One negative point, I guess. I love this game a whole lot, but one of my beef with the game is your starting goals.
Yeah.
Now you know you have one easy and two harder to start with, but you know it depending on what your strategy is, those goals will sometimes combo with each other. Mm-hmm. Like if you get a goal where you need to buy a certain type of jewelry, and you also get the goal where you need X amount of ladies, those two go together.
Right.
And this last play that we had, none of my goals went together, but yours did, Patrick.
Yes, they did.
So that is one that's a little bit different than a typical Stefan Feld game that I've played, is that the individual goals, usually when everybody plays like Amerigo or Bruges, everybody kind of has the same goals that they're trying to get done. But in Bora Bora, everybody has their own unique starting goals, and that changes as the game goes on.
Yeah. Well, but again, that plays into the predominance of player order, because another thing that player order dictates is how you get to select the available goals that are out there.
That's true, but when you start, you get three goals, and player order has nothing to do with
that. I agree with that. And some people
that was my beef.
Yeah, and I get that. And some people have worked around that. I've seen a variant, we haven't played it yet, where you draft your initial goals. Mm. You get a pool of goals, and you get one pass, and then get one pass. And via that way, you have some more control at the beginning of the game about what goals you're going to end up with, so you can set up that game, you know, strategy, so you can get your synergies working early rather than having to. Because the way that I typically approach that is I try to figure out the priority of my goals and which ones I can get quick and which ones I can let sit percolate for a while so that I can pull goals that are going to work better with me. And so I may have one or two that are kind of my hanger-on goals that I'm like, well, at some point I'm going to have to suck it up and go and get those two men that move the huts, even though that's not a strategy I'm pursuing.
See, and I kind of took it in a different light of that if I had goals that I knew that I'd be able to complete at any round, I hung on to those
and
cycled through the ones that I needed to work hard at because I knew at the end game I'd only be filling in one of them that I'd have a choice of at the last, but I knew those other two were definite going to be completed.
Yeah.
So I kind of looked at it at a different approach.
Well, what I was going to say about the goals is like you get all those God cards, and as long as you have enough offerings, you can really play and get your objectives really without meeting your objectives. Like I think I did that two or three times, and I just went from 6 points to 4 points.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So I wasn't at a total loss. I just had to forfeit
a couple of
something.
Points. Yeah.
But to continue on to what has already been said, in the example where you get a lady, you have to get X amount of ladies or three different types of ladies, and you get the jewelry goal, those two go together. So you can actually get both of those together. But if you have three separate goals that they don't interact
with each
other, at all, you're busy doing one goal. Someone else, like Christina, already has two goals. She already has one already done and almost done with the other one. She can then focus on just getting points elsewhere.
I agree.
On the board.
I agree. Because when you do get into the place where you're having to let your game be dictated by your goals, then that really, I mean, you've got three actions each time.
That's it. Yeah.
And now you can synergize that if you're able to select certain men or women so that you can take an extra action here or there, you know, a significant action.
Right.
You know, one of the things that I was able to do is was able to use the city building card at a key time where I was able to really kind of, at the end of a turn, I was able to do, after we had done all the die, I was able to do as much with my abilities as I'd been able to do with my die because I had that set up that way. But you're right. The reason I was able to do that is because my goals were able – I wasn't having to focus as heavily on those. I could use those actions not to bulk up my goals but to take extra actions.
So as a Pegheads here, there's a lot to this game. There's a lot of different rules and how those rules interact with each other. There's just a lot of different variations that could happen. What about the replayability? How do you guys feel about that?
Oh, I think it's really replayable. I think we could play it, the four of us, and play a different, completely different game every single time.
Yeah.
Because I already know what my next strategy is, like what I want to go for.
Yeah.
Well, and I think, too, depending on how many people you play with, the action cards change, too.
They do.
So that, you know, adds to the replayability of
the variants. Yeah, in the two-player, you're going to have fewer action cards to choose from. And some of those action cards, for example, in the four-player game, you've got a land expansion tile and a sea expansion tile. In the two-player game,
you have
just one action card that does both, and that's a scaling thing that makes the game unique. And I agree with Carrie in that every time I played this game, and I'll say I won the game we played, the most recent game that we played
by a lot.
I did, but that's the first time that I've won the game, and I have played this quite a few times. And I spent a great deal of energy in the evenings laying in bed after the game was over thinking through, man, I don't get what am I missing about this game, or what tactics can I employ? Can I go this route? Can I go the city building route? Can I go the expansion route? You know, keep trying to come up with ways of doing different strategies. And every time I play, I'm going to want to try new strategies. I don't want to just ride one strategy to victory. I want to try different strategies time and time again.
See, and I would almost wonder if once you find that niche of how to win, wouldn't you want to do that every time?
No, but I think that somebody else is going to have the same way.
I think that's
like
right.
Like, I was going for, like, trying to do the prestige points so that I could go farther in the, you know, go first.
Right.
But it was, like, I was up against a roadblock because Rob had those points already built in, so I gave that up.
Yeah.
So it's just going to depend on what the other person's going to do, because I had these strategies I came in with. We talked it out last night after playing. And I was like, okay, cool. I'm going to play this one. I'm going to win.
You couldn't do it.
And I couldn't do it with you guys because you were doing the same thing.
Yeah, you had that great combo of those prestige that early on you were able to take first player quite easily.
And I bet you guys would come in trying to get huts or something. Like, well, we'll get all the land. Like, we'll get the 12 points that way.
I would be interested to find out if, you know, after a lot of plays, if any of the other people out there have found a strategy that does work.
That's optimal.
Right. You know, because the jewelry seems pretty
juicy. Pretty,
right. And so does the priests.
Yeah. Yeah.
Even though you lost last night, you got a lot of points and you came back really strong with the jewelry and the priest.
Right. Right. Well, the priest. But what I did is I focused even more on the priest earlier in this game. In the last game that I played, I focused on jewelry and went to priest late. I was like, okay, last two rounds, I'm going to try to build up my priest so I can get those big points. You got to kind of establish your place on the priest track early so that you can have, so it takes a while for them to get shuffled off the end. And that seems to be, you know, going those two together seems like a strong tactic to me.
So you guys played yesterday twice, right?
Yeah.
So you played the two player. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Did you guys switch your strategies on the second game? Did you see a lot of difference?
Yeah. The second time we played two players, I was like, well, I'm just going to build as much as I can. And that fell apart because I was focusing on my goals that weren't building goals, and so it just didn't work out for me.
Yeah.
The goals really dictate how you should try to play.
Yeah, and that's the one thing, that's the one nut I keep trying to crack, is how can I free myself from those goals? How can I, what is a tactic in this game where I can liberate myself from being dictated by the goals? Is there any way that I can pursue this game letting the goals kind of fall by the wayside? Because they're big points. And I can't come up with a way. I mean, I do think the goals really have to drive the game to a large degree.
Well, I, with the goals that I found, like this time, I almost all of mine coincided together. Uh-huh. Like whether I was collecting two kinds of fish, or I was collecting sand, or I was collecting, you know, so everything kind of played off of each other. Right. And up until the very end, I was really great with my goals.
Yeah, yeah.
So I just picked really well.
Yeah.
I think.
And I think it's important with this game is that you can't have tunnel vision. You can't be focused on one thing. And I think it's easy to be distracted. Mm-hmm. And you might forget about the priests, or you forget about the prestige points. And I think that's where you have to be really open to the totality of all the actions.
Right. And the theming in this game, that's another thing that's kind of neat about this game, kind of on a different line, is the theming of this game really seems rich. You know, it all seems to be tied into this Bora Bora. By the way, anybody know where Bora Bora is?
It's an island.
It's an island.
In the ocean.
Yes, okay.
In Western Pacific. Right?
We looked it up. Yeah, yeah. We looked it up. I was like, where is Bora Bora? Yeah. It's halfway between Australia and South America.
What?
Like, it is a string of islands way out there. And you know, it's part of the French Polynesia. It was, you know, figured very heavily into, you know, like the mutiny and all these other sort of, you know, expeditions during that era, where they would come to this island. And it, of course, because of its isolation, It retains to this day a lot of the ancient tribal sort of practices that predominated during the origins of that time. But anyways, yeah, I was always like, where is Bora Bora?
How many people live there now?
Did you
check that out?
I'm wondering what the population...
Are they playing Bora Bora?
Bora? Yeah. Yeah. Oh, this isn't realistic at all.
This game is not true.
This tattoo looks nothing like my tattoo.
Yeah, it does seem to have a nice thematic, you know, focus that feels, at least feels, it emulates that sort of, you know, it feels like...
Like an ancient population.
Yeah, yeah. It feels a little like Disney's Polynesia, maybe. But it does have a...
I wonder if Feld... And, you know, if you're listening, Feld, if you're a peghead, let us know.
I have asked you for an interview, Mr.
Right.
Feld. I haven't heard back yet.
Did he visit Bora Bora? Like, could this have been
a write-off?
Bahamas?
Or Hawaii.
Yeah, exactly.
Incas.
Yeah.
What about the value? You can get this game right now and cool stuff for $33.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think that's fabulous.
That's a really decent
price. I actually think
price.
That's good.
Oh, I think that's a fabulous
price.
Yeah, it's pricey.
For this
game. No, I said that's decent.
Yeah.
I think
for all the stuff you get in that,
yeah.
Especially for the replayability.
Yeah. I think that the value on this is exceptional.
Well, and it's a long game.
Right. You get a lot. That's one thing. This needs to be said about this is that it plays pretty long. Like, even, you know, as focused as you are during the game, you're going to be at it for a while.
This goes without saying, though, a two-player game went pretty quick.
Yeah, it did.
Yes.
How quick? Like,
30 minutes? 40 minutes?
That
yeah,
is quick.
Pretty yeah, yeah,
I'd
yes.
say this was an hour and a half, maybe? And, but it seemed long.
Yeah. And I think, too, like, the more you play this game, the more it becomes second nature of the actions and things, so it would go quicker.
Right, right. That is true. I mean, there are going to be times when you're going to have to kind of focus in late in the game, but for the most part, you can plan out your actions pretty well. Well, listen, we have talked a lot about this one. Why don't we go ahead and rank it? Carrie, you wanna break down the rankings for us?
I'll break down the rankings. It's a short ranking. Zero is you do not like the water and you don't want to go to an island.
Mm.
Six, you cannot wait to inhabit that island. 0 to 6.
Yeah,
six,
so zero
being
to
awesome.
Six pegs.
Yes. Yes.
0 to 6 pegs.
All right. So who wants to start?
I'll start.
Okay.
I'm going to give this game a 5 pegs.
Oh, okay.
I really liked this game. When Rob was telling me about it, it was kind of, he scared me with it. He was like, it's, you know, it's real. There's a lot of rules. But once you get that first initial play done, it's so easy to remember the actions and stuff. And so I really enjoyed this game. And I can see how over time you just, like you said, Patrick, you want to think about how can I win this game? Because there's so many options of that end goal.
Right.
So 5 pegs for me.
5 pegs. Okay.
I really want to give this 5 pegs.
Yeah.
No, you're going to say 6. No, yeah, I really,
no, he was getting ready to say split rating.
No, I really want to give it 5. I'm going to give it a 4,
wow.
All right? But I'm going to tell you why I knocked it. One, those starting goals.
Really? That bothers you a lot.
Well, it's random. Well, I mean, it is random, but it could... You know, I like a game that everybody starts off on an equal footing. Again,
okay.
You know,
okay.
Bruges, you get cards. Some of those cards could be more powerful than other cards, but it's still kind of an equal footing. You know, Amerigo is still kind of the same situation. You're all trying to... But the goals could really... hinder someone. Patrick, you and I played before, and you had the same problem where none of your goals worked.
They didn't work.
So, but it's still, I mean, you can adapt, but it's harder to adapt.
It is. You do get into you can get yourself into a hole.
And the second one is there is a lot of rules. Now, I don't mind that, but for, you know, I'm recommending for everybody out
right.
there, mm-hmm. and there is a lot that you got to kind of absorb. Definitely, you have to play to learn the rules, you need to play a game, full game, because that'll teach you all the rules, how everything interacts, and how to score. So I'm going to give it a 4. It's really close to a 5, but it's still a 4.
Okay.
Pegs.
I was going to give it a 5, Peg. And okay. I think I'm still going to stick with it. But anytime I go like second or third, I start thinking about like, I like what Rob said about that. But, you know, it's funny. As Patrick told me about this game, and he broke it down into 2 minutes because he knows that's my capacity.
Of rules?
Like, he's like, it's super simple. You're just going to, like, put huts places.
She didn't have the rules in 2 minutes. I just...
What he did is he just told me about it. Like, he prepped it as, like, it's so easy. And then when the rules came out, the first time I was like... What?
This is liar.
Easy. How am I going to ever get this? But I really like the game. I think it's actually pretty easy.
Yeah.
So you gave it
I'm giving it a 5 peg. But I do not recommend it for anyone who does not play games.
Yeah.
It's got to be a middle gamer to high gamer.
Right.
Because you're going to turn them off. Like, if you bring this up, like, if we brought this to my family, they would never play a game with
us.
Even if we said, it's easy, it's easy. They'd say, no way. You play Bora Bora with me.
Yeah.
Well, I agree with that. So 5 pegs for Carrie. I'm going to give it 5 pegs as well. And I agree with what you say. This is not, you know, this is not a gateway game by any stretch of the imagination. But I do think this is a great game to break through to those more complex games. If you're wanting to get into some brain burners and you're wanting to get into some longer games, you're wanting to kind of take it up to that you know, pro class level, if you will, this is the game that can get you there, I think. It's a nice game to get you used to complex decision making. It's a nice game that can get you used to a lot of actions to select. It's a nice game that can get you into balancing difficult decisions. I think it is a complex game, but it's a game that once you learn it, you can start engaging with it and you can start working with it. So I'm going to give it 5 pegs. I think it's a really great game and one that I look forward to playing again.
So to sum up, Christina gives it a 5. I give it a 4. Carrie gives it a 5. And Patrick gives it a 5.
All right.
That's a good solid rating.
Well, listen.
It is. It's a good game.
It is. Enough of Bora Bora. We're going to move on to our topic for the week. And we're going to talk to you guys a little bit about the meta game.
You're listening to Blue Peg, Pink Peg, a proud member of the Dice Tower Network.
All I have to do is divine from what I know of you. Are you the sort of man who would put the poison into his own goblet or his enemies? Now, a clever man would put the poison into his own goblet because he would know that only a great fool would reach for what he was given. I'm not a great fool, so I can clearly not choose the wine in front of you. But you must have known I was not a great fool. You would have counted on it.
All right, so we're going to talk a little bit about the meta, but let's first define the meta. Patrick, you have a knack with words. Why don't you define a meta for us?
Well, the way I think about the meta game is it's the game outside of the game. The experience of playing with people over a long period of time lets you know a little bit about the way that they play games and the ways that you may want to interact with them when you're playing a game. The classic example of a meta is a tell in poker or any game where there's hidden information. If someone has a tell, the metagame is the portion of the game where you identify that from your prior experience in order to know how they're going to act and what they're likely to do during a particular time in the game. It also can relate to the personal interactions that you bring into the game that influence the way that the game plays. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean we're going to kind of exclude for our purposes, you know, the people that you just like to annihilate because you don't like them. Okay, we're gonna assume that for our purposes, we're going to talk about playing. You know, maybe you may do that, but for reasons that are related to gameplay, not related to your personal animus that you may have towards an individual. That does exist, but we're not gonna dwell upon that too much. So I guess I want to ask you guys, where are some places that you have seen the
experience outside of a particular game influence the way that people play with you within a game?
Well, you phrased it weird.
Okay.
But, I mean, I know that when I play a game with people that I normally play with, if all things are constant and there's a way to hurt another opponent or king make or whatever the case may be, I am targeted first to take the hit.
Right.
Because I'm competitive. Yep. I play to win. I can usually figure out games pretty quickly. So when I'm sitting down with, you know, three or four people, boom, I'm hit first with all the negative things.
You're a threat.
Yeah.
Well, I'm a threat, but that's because people have played with me in the past, and that's my meta, you know? And another thing is, and this is big for you, Patrick, negotiation.
Mm-hmm.
It's a little different, I think, for me from you, is that when I go to a negotiate, if I'm in sort of game where I'm going to trade some resources, no one trades with me because they're like, he's getting one. I'm like, look, no, this will help you.
Right.
And it actually doesn't help. But they're, no, you're going to screw me somehow.
Right, right.
And that's frustrating for
me. Right. Actually, when you just said that, like, when you give me help in a game, I don't discount it. I'm like, okay, wait, Rob said something and that sounds good. Like, when Patrick does it, I get angry.
That's
but I feel like you're actually doing it to help me. Like, you know, look at all of your different things.
I am.
No, because when you just play for me.
Because when Rob does it for Carrie, I get mad at Rob. Not because I don't like. I'm like, Carrie knows the game. Like, she can do
but
it.
Normally, if he does it, it's because he knows. Like, he can see. Like, okay, she really has a question about this.
Right.
And lots of times, I don't feel comfortable, especially if y'all have played the game and it's my first time asking. But I don't feel like you are like trying to get me to play so that you'll win. You're like,
right.
Really, you need to know what like these shells do, Carrie.
So our meta, it's our relationship. Patrick
right.
and I can both give you the same advice.
No,
or
it's different.
Give you the same.
It's totally different.
But you're like, Rob's trying to help me. Patrick's gonna screw me
because you're not grabbing my pieces at the same time.
Yeah,
but that's
by
a whole
that,
different story.
Maple.
We're not talking about this kind of meta. But one thing, like you said, that you feel like you get targeted, and Christina's a game partner that you play with in all realms.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Do you feel like he gets targeted?
Yeah, he does.
You do.
Yeah, so I help. I contribute to that
like,
a little bit.
He's not got baggage. Like, oh,
no,
everybody's trying
no,
to get
like
me.
That's not in his head. Like, that's like a true thing.
Well,
and
I think
sad.
No, well, I think it goes back into that he is really good and knowledgeable about games, and this is kind of where I see some meta happening. Is that if I know someone has a favorite game or plays a game a lot, like I know going to that game, like. They already know how to win this game. So it's kind of like I go in with this defeatist, like they're going to do what they do. They know a secret about this game that I don't know. And so they're going to win. And so, okay, I'll play, but I'm not going to win this game.
And I can complain about this, but I do the exact same thing. If I'm playing a game with Patrick with maybe two other people that are not as strong, in quotation mark,
Christina and Carrie, I know.
I really
he
didn't
did not
mean
look
that
at
up until
he
that
like
point.
Looked down.
And then I'm like, oh no. But if I'm playing with two other people and I wasn't thinking about you guys much, but I will target Patrick first because I know he's a bigger threat, and that's just from playing with Patrick in past games.
But Patrick doesn't win a lot. Normally, Christina and I come in before Patrick, I think, in a lot of the game.
Well, because I'm putting Patrick down.
Yeah, there is.
So
there
maybe
is
you should like target us.
Yeah. So that's why we win, Carrie's, because
he's targeting.
Rob Hart targets Patrick, and we somehow
win.
Oh,
I knew there was a reason.
Yeah.
No, it has nothing to do with the fact that you are exceptional game players. And I think that there's truth to that. I do think the backside of the meta, however, is the perception of being targeted, and you do this sometimes, but I've seen others do it a lot more, where you're very vocal about being targeted. Guys, everybody is coming up on me, blah, 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 trying to shield off.
That's part of the game.
Yeah, that's a metagame too.
It's very uncomfortable for me to be on the recipient part of that.
Yeah.
I'm not really good at trying to put people down, and I'm competitive, but I don't want to hurt anyone's feelings at the same time.
Yeah, and see what I do.
Every time you beat me, you hurt my feelings. So just remember.
But you're not crying about it on the other side.
Well, not until I get home.
I think that depends on which gaming group you're with. Like, mm-hmm. if you're with a group that you game with all the time, like, you guys are yelling and cursing at each other, threatening to punch each other in the face if they say one more word.
I think I need to get to that point. I need to get more comfortable with being the
it's
competitive
not good.
Side of me.
No. Yeah. Well, what I'll say is, my experience is when somebody's very vocal about that, I have to tell you, the way the meta works for me is I
that flares me up.
Yeah,
I'm like,
me
you know
too.
What? You're doing that because you want me to you feel vulnerable and you want me to spend my attention somewhere else. And when somebody's telling me, look at him, he's got such and such, he's got this and that, I'm like, I don't care.
Wait.
Well, I'm going with my instincts.
Speaking of meta, now I'm going to do it. So clearly you can't drink the wine in front of me because I know that you're going to know that I'm going to do that.
There.
So I'm going to flip it around and do something different.
So it's really just a big game of reverse psychology.
Yes,
for everybody.
Yes, exactly. It's the Princess Bride.
But you know, when we were talking about this topic and Patrick was like explaining the whole metagame, and we were talking, I kept coming back to like Survivor and how we did that at your house.
Yeah.
Like that's really what it is. If you think about the metagame, it's how people win Survivor.
Yeah, it's thinking outside of what's actually in front of you.
And playing people. And
right. And what I think, my metagame that's a big one for me is I really bring into past experiences of playing with people into how I engage with them in the future.
Expand on that because I think that's interesting too.
Yeah, like, okay, so AJ, he does
AJ.
This thing where he plays a game and he goes, I'm not going to win now because you guys all, you know, bleeped me from the behind and like I can't.
And that's kind of what he said.
He doesn't use that phrase.
No, he says something else.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
He does that constantly in the game and it's just like annoying. And it's like, okay, if you think you're going to lose, then I really want to beat you.
Yeah.
And so, I, you know, that happens. And then I also think that people who like...
Poor AJ.
Don't be an AJ.
Don't be an AJ.
Poor AJ. He's a great
For
guy.
For the record, I really... adore AJ.
Oh, yeah. We all do.
And then too, like, you know, we were talking about like trading games and negotiating games. Like, I don't like trading with Patrick because he's like not very nice about it. We're negotiating about things like, because he'll say things like, well, that's a dumb move. And it's like, oh my God, okay, well, I'm sorry.
When he gets angry and kind of spits at you.
Yeah, a little bit.
Wow.
That adds to my mind that I know people don't like to deal with Patrick, so I'm Mr. Nice Guy.
So I think, you know, I think it really depends on who you're with, but it's hard not to leave that stuff at the door.
Yeah. I don't think you should, honestly. I mean, I think that knowing that stuff will influence, because we have proclivities. We have certain styles that we go into games with. And if you become familiar with the styles of a particular player, then you need to bring that awareness to your gameplay with them. So I think that's a part of the meta that's very valid. But a less valid part of the meta I'm going to speak about in prior experiences. If somebody has beaten me down or someone's done me wrong in a game, you know,
you're
taking me out,
grudges?
I will come for them. If I am in a position of being a kingmaker and I can't win the game and you have done me wrong, then there will be, it may not be today, it may not be tomorrow, but one day your due will come and I will ruin you in a game.
He has a checklist that he keeps in the bathroom.
I do. I'm like, I'm like Arya. I go to bed. Yeah. I go to bed every night and I put off a name of list. Rob Rouse, AJ, Franklin.
I just say him, and if
I take them off, I'll take one off the list. That is a way that I do play sometimes. If you know, and I forget about them sometimes, but if it's fresh, I'm gonna go for it.
So here's a question. So part of the metagame is like if you know something about a game, but you're playing it with people who've never played before.
Mm-hmm.
So you're kind of like, I know what I'm gonna do because I have experience with this game. What I like to do is I'll ask people like, so how's the best way to win this game? So is that something you would share with new players, or would you keep that a secret?
I always share it. I feel like it's unfair. Like when I've like explained games or played, like I've been the one who's played.
Yeah.
I wasn't like, okay, well, this is a strategy that worked last time.
Yeah.
Right. Because
I feel like then if it's on the table, then everyone, like being the person who's always the underdog. Like,
right.
Yeah. Because I'm the new one.
Right.
So I don't want anyone else to feel that way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Baptismal by fire, baby.
Yeah, nice. I have I'm of two minds on that, you know.
Well, Rob had one, but
I had a mind.
Go on.
But no, if they lose by not doing something the next time we play, they're like, oh, hey, that works.
Right.
Versus me saying, hey, you might want to build a road here. You know, they're like, well, so you say. I don't believe you. You're a liar.
But I don't think like giving exact directions, but as you're like explaining the game.
Right, like saying, like, okay, would this strategy be better than this one?
Yeah, like you could really work for, like in Bora Bora, you could really work for building huts and trying to be the capture of all the fish at
right.
the end.
Right. Like right. if I was new to a game and I would have asked, is it really behooving of me to buy a lot of jewelry, Rob? Would it be?
No, don't buy any jewelry. What are you talking about?
Absolutely not.
Yeah, and my take on that is that I kind of agree with Rob in that the experience of playing a game is the best teaching tool for mm-hmm. learning to play a game. But I do think that if I'm playing with new players, I want them to have a sense. I usually do take some time to say, hey, here's a general strategy
yeah.
that you may want to employ. You know, if I'm playing a game where there's going to be big in-game bonuses at the game, I'll say to them, look, don't lose sight of the in-game bonuses. Those are going to be big for you in this game, and so you really want to focus on that. Or if there's one card that is especially powerful, you know, that comes out, I don't want them to pass it up and give it to me, you know, because they don't know.
Because they don't know.
You know? Right. So I'd be like, you know, I mean, I've had games of Seven Wonders where somebody passes me, a brand new player passes me a card that I'm like, there's no way that they should give this to me. I'll go to them and go, look, you know, this is an incredibly powerful card.
Yeah.
I think you may want to hold on to this because if anybody else
and
had done it.
And now there's five other players in the game waiting for you to explore.
Well, you know what? But the thing is that in that, it's not fair for those other
right.
five players if I'm getting loaded up because I'm next to somebody who doesn't have a knowledge of the cards.
That's a big metagame
you know?
Right there.
What's
talking
that?
About but, Valuspa!
Yeah, well,
what's
I mean.
The metagame? What it,
that you. You could strategically decide where you sit when you play a board game because you know you're going to sit next to someone
and
who is
example,
not as good.
And a good example of that
is Valuspa.
Yeah.
When with those Hydra cards, you're always trying to place a Hydra down, and that scores you a lot of points. And
right.
if you're sitting next to someone who doesn't...
They get it, but they're not
paying
attention.
They don't understand
attention.
The strategy
yeah.
of how to block that.
Yeah.
They're constantly setting up that person
right.
to get
it.
That
points.
Is a good metagame, and
oh,
I
yeah.
love Valuspa.
Yeah.
I'm going to start winning all the time.
Yeah. yeah.
But
yeah.
I the
I'll
reason,
tell you who to sit next to.
Yeah. I,
that
the reason
person
I,
is me.
The reason I ask that question is because if you're, you know, bringing in new gamers into your gaming group a lot, to just think about that, because I'm with Carrie. I don't like to be the underdog at the table, and I feel... You know, it's defeated if I am walking into a room of gamers playing a game. So, like, sharing those strategies or sharing that information would maybe be a nice thing to do.
Well,
yeah.
If it helps me, I'll definitely share it out. For example, Cosmic Encounter. You know, you pick those starting races right off the start. Everybody has a different power. Some of those are more powerful than others.
Yeah.
So if we have a new player sitting down and someone gets this awesome monster card, I was like, look. This is what we're going to have to do as a group or we're all going to be destroyed.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, and you do that a lot too. Like, and I don't think you do it consciously. Sometimes you'll say things out loud that is totally going to screw someone else at the table.
Like today, he did it
yeah,
for Bora Bora.
Yeah, he did when we played Bora Bora this
and
last
actually,
round.
And actually, when I asked that question, I felt guilty because I was just asking it out loud
right.
because I was trying to find it myself.
What question are we talking about?
The fish. I was trying to find
she
the fish that I had to match.
And I was like,
and
oh,
I was
right
in the
here.
Middle of finding it myself, so you didn't have to point it.
Yeah.
But then... Rob said, oh, Christina's going for that one. And I was like, oh, now I'm going to feel guilty. And I took it anyway. I think
yeah.
it's the first time I knowingly took something
that was going to
someone else wanted, but it would be good for
How
me.
How did it feel?
I felt a little Catholic in that I felt like...
Your guilt came up on you?
Yeah, my guilt came up.
Guilty.
Yep. And so everybody, as far as the metagame is concerned, you need to know that Carrie is inclined to... pangs of guilt. So if you can
so
trigger that in her,
when I'm just talking
you,
out loud.
Yeah, you might be in a good position of leveraging that to
oh,
your
geez.
Advantage. So there's a metagame tip for those of you out there.
One of the things you mentioned in the intro that I use a lot is other players' ticks
yeah.
and things Ooh. That they do. Mm-hmm. Like I know I have this buddy that when he gets
Don't
have
say
one.
It, dude, because we played poker with that guy.
How did you know I was going to come
I know exactly
well,
what you're going to say.
No, now I know who it is.
But he, when he gets a good card, there's a couple things he does, but one of the big things he does is he gets a card, he puts the card down, and he shifts up. He gets on top of the board. He's now interested in what's happening and what the bets are. But that, just poker aside, he does that in all the board games.
Yeah.
So I know that once he does this move where he's sitting up, his elbows are on the table,
coming.
There's something big coming.
Right.
I now have to be on top.
Right.
And you
got to pay attention.
That's his poker face?
No.
Oh, no,
it's not. You've got to pay attention to that. And you then at that time when he does that, and I'm the same way with him, when he does that, because he's a very good game player.
He is.
When he does that, I'm thinking, uh-oh, what did he see I need to pay attention to, because there's something that he is got going and I'm missing it.
Yeah, it's funny.
And yeah, so that is a big part. That, you know, not just poker. You're right. It comes out in other games,
any,
too.
Any kind of hidden knowledge game where someone has some sort of hidden knowledge that you don't know what they
right.
have. All the cards are not on the table, you know, tiles, whatever. When this person picks it, I watch everybody as they pick a tile, but when this person picks it and they do this move, I'm like, oh my God.
Okay, I'm going to tip you guys off on one of my tells.
Oh.
If ever you see me and I start getting anxious to make my move, or I accidentally skip somebody,
ooh,
then I have got a great play that I'm setting up.
You do that a lot.
That seems obvious.
Yeah. Yeah.
I cross my fingers.
Well, I'm really bad about it. I'm really bad about
Patrick's
it.
Patrick's like, well, sometimes if I start to whistle before my turn, that means I've got it. It seems obvious.
But that's mine. Like, when I'm thinking I'm winning, I like whistle. I whistled while I was winning. But that's, you know.
But you didn't know you did that until Rob said, oh, man, she's whistling.
Yeah.
And we got a problem, everybody.
Yeah, yeah.
Again, I brought that to everybody's attention.
Yes, yes. Well, that's another thing about the game, is that if you've got somebody, this is the flip side of what you're talking about. If there's somebody who takes advantage of someone's weaknesses or, you know, their lacking knowledge of the game, that's something. I know people who do that. I know people who will sit there quietly while a player who is not as experienced makes a suboptimal play. And when I see that in a game, when I play games with those people with newer players, I'm going to be really focused on taking that person down. I'm going to be a little more attentive to taking them out, because I don't feel like it's
like
my place
it out
to
for
say,
the other person.
Yeah, it's not my place to say,
oh,
you should
nice
have showed
protective.
Them that. Mm-hmm. But I'm going to, I do get a little bit defensive within the context of the game. So that's sort of one of the ways that I let the meta kind of manifest itself. You know, it's subtle, but it definitely has a place in the way that I play the games. And then the other thing is that, you know, when there are certain players who will employ a certain tactic, and I know that they like to use that tactic. Case in point, Stone Age. In Stone Age, one of the tactics you can employ is to starve your people. Okay? And there's a couple of people that I play with that are really good at employing that. They do the same thing at Agricola. And I will always try to disrupt that for them. I always try to force them into going a route that doesn't allow them to starve their people. It's harder to do, but I will try to disrupt that tactic. You know, if I know there's a tactic that somebody employs, I'm going to use my ability to try to disrupt that, even sometimes to the detriment of my own game. You know, I just don't want them beating me that way.
Yeah. Yeah. And we talked about that a little bit when we played Bora Boras. It was like, you know, it was clear that someone was going to get a buku amount of points. And so it's like, well, who's going to take the hit on blocking them? It's like,
right.
I'm not going to do it. You got to do it.
Right.
And so I don't know. I think it'd be interesting. I don't want to talk a lot about the differences between men and women, but like, for me, my metagame is more about relationships, and it sounds like for you and Rob, your metagame is more about tactics.
Mine's more about relationships and the way it makes me feel inside.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, am I going to feel guilty, or am I going to feel like, oh, I don't want to do that because it's going to make that guy angry?
Or even like,
know?
If I play a game with someone and I can figure out what kind of games they like and what kind of games they don't like, I'm going to stay away from the games they don't like the next time we play something.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And that's about being a good game partner. Well, before we let's start to wrap it up. But before we wrap it up, I do want to have like a little one thing. We are a couples podcast. We touched upon this briefly. I do want to talk about how does the meta manifest for you guys as a couple? Okay. Carrie has said that for her, she is a little dubious of any instruction that I give or resentful.
I'm going to talk about this really quick because you've been so great about it. You made like a pact for New Year's or something that you wouldn't play for me.
Yeah.
And then last night you did it.
Oh, no.
And it was awful. Like immediately I went right back to like that 6 months ago and I got really angry.
Uh-huh.
And then I backed off.
Yeah, well, you did, but you lost your train of thought because he couldn't play for himself. And I'm like, just stop playing for me.
Yeah, I did.
And so
I
we like, got in this little tiff, and he's like, well, now I can't concentrate on my own move. And I was like, because you should have been concentrating on your move.
That's true. She's right.
So, like, for me, that is my biggest, like, it was surprising how angry and upset I got so quickly.
Oh. Yeah, you have
because
issues with that.
If somebody else did it or had you done it like 2 years ago, it would have been fine.
Right, right. Well, here's
that's my metagame. Play for me.
Here's my meta.
If I ask for advice, that's cool.
Leaving aside the fact that I sit on my hands whenever I play games with Carrie. Keep my hands off of bits. The other thing is that I am pretty slow to annihilate her. like I will not put her into
the ground.
But
you need to start being
more agree with that?
Because I don't think you're that good of a gamer.
Oh.
Because you're not playing. If you're not really playing for me, like before I always thought because you were playing against yourself and I would just sit there. But like, I want to be competitive with you. Don't just sit there and let me win.
Oh, no. I'm not gonna let you win, but I'm just not going to blow you out of the water if
but
I can
But you should.
Avoid it. Well, it's just it's one of my things.
I mean, y'all are a couple. Isn't it more fun to play when someone's actually playing?
Oh,
when he said that, I was so insulted.
Now?
No, you said it yesterday.
Oh, yeah. Well, no, but the fact
is... And now
is,
I'm even more insulted that you're putting it on the air. So I'm going to stop
talking.
And our
next podcast will be therapy.
What about you guys?
I really wish that we had one, but we don't. We know each other so well.
And you love each other so much.
No, it's not that. It's not, I can barely stare at the woman. No, we know each other so well that Christina knows how I play a game.
Yeah.
I know how she plays a game, and we know that each other knows how we play a game. So metas for us personally don't really, and I'm speaking for both of us, but she could go back on that, don't really come into play as much as the game itself. Like,
right.
If we know, you know, this particular strategy is very good and we see that someone's going for that strategy, we will then go for a counter,
mm-hmm.
you know, and stuff of that nature. But it's the game itself that has the meta. Like, you know, just like I said, strategies versus us. I don't think that really plays with our one-on-one gaming.
Yeah, I would just say that I know that, you know, we know that we're both competitive. And so you layered that with, I know Rob really likes to play board games.
Mm-hmm.
So when I play with him, it's like, I play really hard because I want to beat him at his own jig.
Yeah.
Like, But he knows that. Like, and he knows that I get mad if he tries to be nice to me.
Yeah,
yeah, when he said that the other day, I was like, really?
Yeah, wait, I want to be clear. I need to clarify. For the sake of my
No. We're with Rob and Christina now.
No. I gotta clarify.
You hear a backpedal?
Yeah. What I'm saying is I will play to win. I always play to win, but it's just like I'm not gonna, you know, if I gotta play worse. Against four people,
there's a shovel.
Yeah.
Now that being said, both of us, if we're playing with other people, will inform the other people about our spouses, advantages, disadvantages, how they play, stuff like that.
Yeah, that's true. So you tip everybody off to their particular.
Right. By the way, Rob plays games really well. Get him first.
All right. Well, everybody, hopefully that has told you a little bit about our take on the meta and our take on some other things as well. And and we hope that you guys have gotten something out of this. Hopefully we have as well. So listen, before we appreciate you guys being with us. We appreciate you guys listening to us as always. And as always, have some fun.
play
some games.
Send money for therapy.
Thanks for joining us for another episode of Blue Peg, Pink Peg. If you want to hear more about Blue Peg, Pink Peg, why not head over to our webpage at www.bluepegpinkpeg. There you can check out our show notes, you can check out our rating summaries, you can rate us, and you can also find out more about each of the pegs and all the things that we're doing. If you want to follow Blue Peg Pink Peg or join the conversation, you can always check us out at Twitter, Stitcher, Facebook, and Board Game Geek, all by searching Blue Peg Pink Peg. If you want to go over to Board Game Geek and join our guild, you can do so. You can interact with us and other members of the Peghead Nation. Blue Peg Pink Peg is a proud member of the Dice Tower Network. If you have any questions, concerns, or other things you want to discuss with any of the pegs, you can email us at bluepegpinkpeg@gmail.com. Blue Peg Pink Peg is a production of In Your Ear Media. All rights reserved.
Blue Peg Pink Peg's theme music is written by Skavoovy and the Epitope.